Tamily Sells.
That's correct. May it please the Court, I do represent Mr. Sells in this denial of habeas corpus relief in the District Court. I've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a matter which has just arisen in the Court, which I'm going to need to discuss for a short moment. After that, I will move on to what I deem as my main argument, which concerns the application of the very recent United States Supreme Court decision in Trevino versus Thaler. And then, time permitting, I will say a little concerning the trial court's exclusion of a critical defense exhibit. The matter that has arisen is this. The director has served upon the parties a 28J letter raising the case of Cullen versus Pinholster. Neither my colleague, Mr. Futrell, nor I were aware that that had been served. I do not know why, but I do not appear to have received it on the ECF system. So it has only just come to our attention. Consequently, I'm going to address the Court on it very briefly and may seek to file a letter brief subsequently to discuss why Cullen versus Pinholster is inapplicable to this case. The respondent's position seems to be that Mr. Sells' ineffective assistance of counsel claim, his Wiggins claim, was adjudicated on the merits in the state courts. It was the position of the respondent in the court below that the matter was not exhausted and that therefore a de novo review was applicable. In those circumstances, Cullen versus Pinholster has no application. Cullen is limited to cases that have been adjudicated on their merits. So this is a case that is not a new case. It's being raised for the first time at the 11th hour, and it's abandoning a position taken in the district court. It was not raised in the certificate of appealability. And I would submit that given the circumstances of this case, it is not fair to say that whatever facts were found in the state court should be accorded a presumption of correctness because of the ineffective assistance that Mr. Sells received in the initial state habeas proceeding. They're not worthy of any presumption of correctness. It was not a fair fact-finding, and many of the findings that were made were mixed decisions of fact and law to which the normal presumption of correctness would not apply. They weren't just simple findings of pure fact. So we will reserve the right, if I may ask for that, to submit a subsequent letter concerning this, but we are surprised at this 180-degree change in the respondent's position at the 11th hour and citing a case which was, in fact, it's not intervening authority. It was available all along. Let me move on to the big question in this case, which is the applicability of Trevino versus Thaler. Trevino has changed the law from where it was just 8 days ago.
And why aren't they correct, though, about a Pinholster? I mean, you really don't have any new claims, do you? I mean, it's the same claim that you've always had, ineffective counsel, based on the fact that you did not pursue mitigating evidence in an aggressive way. That's the same claim.
It is the same,
and all you've done is just pile a new evidence, a little evidence on it.
But the merits of the claim as they existed in the first state habeas proceeding are very different from the merits as subsequently developed, and we would say still only incompletely developed. Those facts were found by the Texas courts in the first state habeas proceedings were the fruits of a proceeding in which the habeas attorney had virtually abdicated his role, and therefore this was not a factual proceeding which should be accorded any deference or presumption of correctness. It was such an inadequate proceeding that it would be unfair to...
So inadequate? I mean, what made it so terribly inadequate? What did he fail to find that made counsel so ineffectively that the petitioner was effectively without counsel?
He essentially conducted no real investigation and consequently came up with nothing that was really not known.
What did he come up with? What did you come up with? Or what did his second and third habeas counsel come up with?
What we have now is a factual record which is still undeveloped because of the denial of means in the district court, but where it is clear that there are facts concerning Mr. Sells, which, had they been presented to the jury, might have been persuasive as the basis for a sentence less than death. For example, the likelihood that Mr. Sells has fetal alcohol syndrome as a result of his mother's alcohol consumption during pregnancy. His trial attorney and his state habeas attorney did not have his school records, which reveal a child struggling in school, begging for special help, and consistently failing. And it is clear from the record that the people assisting trial counsel, the psychologist and the mitigation specialist, were well aware that they could not do their job because they did not have time or funding to do so, and they were not able to develop the case then as it should have been. We would say that it is still undeveloped, but that there are facts which have come to light which should have been presented at trial and consequently should have been presented in the first state habeas proceeding. Moreover, there's...
Did present Dickinson, the psychologist, who I thought gave a pretty thorough analysis of how messed up this guy was.
Dr. Dickinson did present a good deal of information, little of which was actually conclusive as to diagnosis, and virtually none of which actually presented mitigating evidence in the sense of facts concerning this individual that would tend to humanize him in the eyes of the jury. The, as it were, biographical data available to the jury about this gentleman before the court was virtually none. It came down to a few snippets of information about his sister having died in infancy and that he had been slow to walk, and a few facts like that. Nothing like the narrative of a human life which might persuade a jury that this was indeed a human being worth saving. And for that reason, we say that the state habeas attorney was ineffective. He should have gathered up relevant information that should have been presented to the jury at trial, and he did not. We have done some of the work that is necessary to build up that picture of the facts of the man's life, and as yet have not been able to do so because of the denial of means in the district court. Martinez and Trevino now lead the way to our being able to do so, and I would submit to the court that we already meet two of the factors that are necessary to be found under Martinez. The first state habeas was the initial collateral review proceeding as required by Trevino and Martinez. It was a stage which under Texas law one had to raise ineffective assistance of trial counsel at that point in that first proceeding, and both those things hold true. The two factors under Martinez that have not yet been established are whether there was a substantial ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim and the ineffectiveness of state habeas counsel as being cause for that claim having become defaulted. So what we ask the court today is to remand this case to the district court so that the factual record can at last be properly developed, a chance we have not had so far, and so that we can establish substantiality and the ineffective assistance of habeas counsel as cause. And because this is a situation where the underlying merits of the case are so much bound up with the question of cause, the substantiality goes hand in hand with cause, both matters require to be developed. I would like to deal very briefly with a procedural matter which may be a red herring, or certainly something that has obscured the merit of Mr. Sells' case, and that's the question of exhaustion and procedural default. There seems to be an argument in this case as to whose fault the default is. Mr. Sells says very firmly it's the fault of state habeas counsel in the first instance that this claim was not properly fleshed out and litigated in the state courts. The respondent says that because of actions taken by Mr. Sells' federal habeas counsel, the claim somehow became unexhausted and therefore defaulted, and that because it is Mr. Sells' fault at this point, the court should not reach the merits of the issue. We would submit that there's no available way to have litigated the additional evidence of which the district court and the director complain in the state courts. Once his first state habeas was filed and the true merit of the claim defaulted, there was no subsequent opportunity at which the state courts would consider on the merits anything that he subsequently filed concerning ineffective assistance of counsel. He raised an Atkins claim, but that was limited to the scope of the Atkins inquiry. And there was the brief period of time in late 2010 when the Ruiz and Ballantyne cases tended to suggest there might be an avenue for review opening up again in state court. But we know that that, in fact, was not so, and that the subsequent application that was filed was immediately, more or less, dismissed as an abuse of the writ. So the additional factual material that was filed in the federal court, the district court, was automatically exhausted because there was no available channel for its review in the state courts under 2254B. So the question of why there should be an additional default, we would suggest, is one for which there is no basis whatsoever in law. It's clear that the district court and the director were not pleased by the filing of additional factual material, but to sanction Mr. Sells because this matter was not properly litigated in the first instance on the basis of his failure to take a subsequent futile act in the state court has absolutely no basis in law, and this court should not sanction it. So what we ask is for the court to permit us to return to the district court and to have the matter reviewed there where it properly should be. These are matters which will need to be reviewed, we say, de novo, because there was no worthy merits ruling in the state courts to which this court should give deference or any presumption of correctness. The district court acknowledged the existence of Martinez and its substantiality standard, the certificate of appealability standard, as the correct standard of review, but proceeded to review all of Mr. Sells' claim by the full-blown Strickland standard, a full merits review for a claim which was assuredly undeveloped at that point. And that is the reason the case needs to be sent back to be developed and then re-reviewed under the correct standard and having been properly developed, for which we would require the means to enlarge the facts, to seek investigation and possibly depositions. We're very much in the same situation, I would suggest, as a petitioner who's seeking to bring a previously unavailable claim in a successive petition, such as an Atkins claim. In those circumstances, this circuit requires only a colorable showing of a possibly meritorious claim, what's been described as a modest evidentiary threshold. And we would suggest that we meet that threshold. We have enough facts here to show that these claims should proceed forward, and we are in a situation where additional assistance for Mr. Sells is reasonably necessary under the standards of 3599 and McFarland versus Scott. It's quite true that Mr. Sells had some assistance from the court when he raised an Atkins claim, but I would suggest that at that point, Atkins has a very different focus. It's not a pure mitigation issue. It's to do with how the defendant functions in his environment. A Wiggins claim, an ineffectiveness claim, is a more global, a wide-ranging claim to do with other factors as to how the defendant, the petitioner's environment, has affected him over the course of his life, which in Mr. Sell's case was some 36 years at the time of his conviction. And all of these factual areas, such as his fetal alcohol syndrome, such as the familial setting in which he grew up, with apparently neglect and being shunned by his own mother, who didn't want him, but when somebody else sought to adopt him, wouldn't let them have him. These are the types of facts which might have served as a basis for a jury decision other than death, but have not been developed and which cry out for that now. And we'd say that if we are not afforded this opportunity for which we ask to remand and develop, we cannot show the necessary cause under Martinez. We would be in very much the same situation of somebody who says, I can prove that I have a miscarriage of justice exception to default, but I need DNA testing. If that person's denied the DNA testing, they can't prove that they might be innocent and therefore have the miscarriage of justice exception, and they will never be able to litigate their claims, which is a concern that Martinez clearly points out, that one should have a chance to litigate claims before a state court. And particularly in this case...
Now, why is the evidence, though, that of this so-called mitigating evidence so powerful that it would affect the verdict of someone as guilty of this crime, this particular crime, and all of the testimony about what a violent, evil man he was? I mean, to slit the throats of people that he didn't know, to slit the throats of these little girls, and even in prison, I mean, he was had the reputation apparently, I mean, of being a totally violent person. I mean, how would the fact that his mother drank martinis on Saturday night or drank margaritas on Saturday night affect one's judgment in the face of that kind of evidence?
First of all, there was no record evidence before the jury at trial that Mr. Sells had a general reputation for prison violence. There was one inmate witness who was hoping to get his charges reduced, who said that Mr. Sells had threatened him.
Yeah, but you don't deny, I mean, that the psychiatrist, I mean, the evidence was certainly sufficient for the jury to determine that this was an extraordinarily violent man, do you?
And that is precisely the point, if I may say so, that without additional information about the individual to supply an answer to the mitigation question that might be difficult.
Mitigating, and that explains why he is the evil, horrible, violent man that he is. That helps explain it, but it doesn't, it helps explain why he is the way he is. But how does that really mitigate the death sentence under these circumstances?
A jury might find that if somebody is
like what?
Not responsible for the circumstances in which they grew up, if the mother drinks before the child is even born, he has no control over that. If that affects his ability...
They don't even know that that affected him, do you?
We know that...
Speculation.
We know that his mother says that, yes, she did drink during pregnancy, probably on many, several occasions. And we know...
A lot of people have done that. I mean, a lot of mothers of very respectable people have done that, you know, back before it became known that you shouldn't do it.
And now we know that there is a correlation between alcohol consumption during pregnancy and fetal alcohol syndrome. We have the affidavits of experts in that field.
I was under the impression, I mean, she was not an alcoholic. I mean, there was some speculation about that, but I mean, you could basically just show that she... drank some while he...
And these are the types of facts which need to be further brought out, but we have not had the means to do so. It is Mrs. Lovins, Mr. Sells' mother's own affidavit is not detailed, but we know from the prison records that Mr. Sells reported that there was alcoholism within the family, his father, his grandfather, and obviously himself.
The fact that his grandfather was an alcoholic, is that going to tell you much about why he should not be held responsible for these horrible murders, or this horrible murder and the other slip-throat in injury to this other young girl? That doesn't tell you much about that, does it?
Your Honor, this is the type of education that of information that the Supreme Court has typically reviewed as having potential mitigating effect. The fact that we're not before the court with a more powerful and comprehensive factual picture is because we have not had the means to flesh that out so that it can be presented. We certainly do not say that this case should be resolved today. It needs to go back
There was some evidence presented that he had suffered from some sort of psychological personality problems that he was not to blame for. Can't you say that the specifics of it, the alcohol situation would have been more specific, but there was evidence that he did suffer from some sort of psychological...
There was evidence that he suffered from conditions, but the full factual picture of what had happened to him that was beyond his control was never brought out. And the fleeting little pieces of information would not, I would submit, make a juror pause and think, there was a story here that I didn't know earlier. Now it's making me think about whether I should, in fact, give this man a chance. The psychological evidence was technical. It was complex. It used long words. There was a lot of it.
Was there any substance to the fact that he apparently bragged that he was a serial killer and had killed hundred other people or something like that?
I don't believe that is in the record, Your Honor, certainly not the record that was before the jury. It appears that Mr. Sells talks a lot but may not always be reliable, which is often a problem with people who do have psychological problems. It's not something that the state, of which the state was able to introduce evidence at trial, and there's nothing in the record that indicates that they actually had that evidence.
Would there have been a greater opportunity for him to present that evidence if the evidence that you now seek to present to the jury had in fact been presented to him? Would that have opened up any opportunities for the state to introduce more adverse evidence against him, including his alleged boast of...
The trial attorney said that he had reduced the mitigation evidence and presented it only through Dr. Dickerson in order to avoid the introduction of extraneous offences. But I think that there's more than one answer to that. First of all, he never said who knew what about which extraneous offence. There would have been other people, for example, school teachers, people who had known Mr. Sells during his youth, people who would be most unlikely to know anything about extraneous offences. But the fundamental problem at this trial was that trial counsel had not had an adequate investigation performed. So if he made a supposedly strategic choice about not presenting evidence, he did so on no basis. He didn't have a reasonable investigation done upon which he could conclude that a particular defense presentation was appropriate.
Did he speak to the mother? Did trial counsel or the investigator speak to the mother?
They did speak to the mother. I see that I'm running out of time. I had wanted to say just a few words, if I may, about Mr. Sells' video claim, which I would submit, especially because this was a case where future dangerousness was in the forefront. The video came.
We'll give you another minute to.
Thank you. The video was very pertinent to future dangerousness. That was really all that the sentencing was about. And this was a case all about sentencing. It would not have been winnable at trial. It's remarkable in a way that it was tried. So this particular exhibit, which was, there's no question that has been raised about its reliability, was a neutral piece of information that would have shown the jury what was available to contain Mr. Sells if he needed containing. And given how extraordinarily slender the defense case was on mitigation and how grave the problem with future dangerousness, it really was a centerpiece of the defense presentation which was yanked away and which the jury never got to hear. And on what basis? I mean, the court might well ask, was it an unreasonable determination of federal law?
Was it discussed by witnesses? I know the video was not seen, but the procedure and the process, was it testimony that was brought out as to how he would be housed if he were to be given a life sentence as opposed to the death sentence? I mean, did it come out other than through the video?
It came out through Dr. Dickerson, who said that the prison system was up to the task of containing Mr. Sells. And then the state brought in Roy Smithy, a so-called prison expert, who told a lurid tale of acts of violence in prison. And this video, which had been sought to be introduced before Mr. Smithy's testimony, the defense also sought to introduce it afterwards to rebut what he had said, because it is a very neutralizing, literally a concrete example of how people can be made to live. And so although there was some overlap, there were many things in the video that are not in the testimony. The way that prisoners are handled when they're fed, when they go to medical appointments, all sorts of details, and the sheer physical reality of a maximum security setting was not explained to the jury.
Now, why don't you begin to finish your argument? I'll give you about another minute to finish up.
Thank you. Let me just, in that case, finish up on the video claim. It was relevant mitigating evidence. It could have served as a basis for a sentence less than death. The Supreme Court, in its adjudication of cases concerning the exclusion of mitigation evidence, I would submit in Sears versus Upton, the recent case, in Green and in Chambers, have looked at two things. They've looked at whether the evidence in question was reliable and therefore overcame the evidentiary objections of the state. Here, there's no questions to reliability. And they also look at whether the application of the evidentiary rule was rote. Was it mechanistic? The opinion of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals gives so little weight to the need of Mr. Sells to present this vital evidence that I would submit that there was here a substantial and injurious effect under the 14th Amendment with regard to this exhibit. And with...
Okay, Ms. Sherrod, I think that's about all.
I will reserve a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Of course, you have reserved five.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Mr. Mitchell, the Attorney General, State Attorney General's Office.
May it please the court. Tommy Lynn Sells is patently ineligible for a certificate of appealability because no reasonable jurist could possibly conclude that Sells is eligible for habeas relief when his claims are examined through the lens of Section 2254D and the Supreme Court's decision in Cullen against Pinholster. Under the Supreme Court's rulings in Slack against McDaniel and Miller L. against Cockrell, a habeas petitioner must make a substantial showing that he will ultimately obtain habeas relief on the constitutional claim that he asserts. When a constitutional claim is undoubtedly barred by Section 2254D or by Teague or by any other decision of the Supreme Court, a certificate of appealability should not issue, even if the habeas applicant makes a substantial showing of the denial of a constitutional right. Each of the two claims that Mr. Sells presents in this case faces an insurmountable obstacle from Section 2254D, as that section has been construed by the Supreme Court. First, the Wiggins claim that Mr. Sells presents is blocked by Section 2254D and by Cullen against Pinholster. This Wiggins claim was presented in Mr. Sells' first state habeas application, and it was adjudicated on the merits by the state courts. This triggers Section 2254D's relitigation bar, and it also triggers Cullen against Pinholster's prohibition on introducing new evidence to support that claim in the federal habeas proceedings. The district court did not cite Pinholster, but Pinholster closes the door on Mr. Sells' attempt to relitigate his Wiggins claim with newly discovered evidence. This is not a new claim, and it is not a defaulted claim. It is the same claim that Sells presented in his first state habeas application. And that these claims are the same is supported not only by the Supreme Court's pronouncement in Pinholster, but also by the Seventh Circuit's decision in Brannigan against the United States, which we cite in our Rule 28J letter. In Pinholster, the federal habeas applicant, after litigating an ineffective assistance claim in state court, sought to introduce new evidence of ineffective assistance in the federal habeas proceeding, which included new testimony from medical experts and new affidavits from persons who had been consulted during the penalty phase of the individual state court trial. The Supreme Court of the United States refused to treat this new evidence as establishing a new or unexhausted ineffective assistance claim. Rather, the justices found that Mr. Pinholster was presenting the same ineffective assistance claim that he had earlier presented in the state court proceedings, and the court refused to allow him to buttress that claim with new evidence. Pinholster is indistinguishable from this case. The new evidence that Mr. Sells seeks to introduce is of the same variety that Mr. Pinholster sought to introduce in his own federal habeas proceeding. In Brannigan against the United States, the Seventh Circuit held that new legal arguments and new evidence about the same events that transpire in court do not amount to a new claim under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. Brannigan's construction of the word claim should be adopted by this court. All of Mr. Sells' complaints surrounding his trial lawyer's alleged failures to investigate mitigating evidence and their alleged failures to present an adequate case in mitigation all amount to the same claim. Sells cannot escape 2254D's relitigation bar, nor can he escape Pinholster's prohibition against introducing new evidence by trying to fob off the Wiggins claim in his federal habeas application as a new or separate or distinct claim from the Wiggins claim that he raised in his initial state habeas application. Martinez against Ryan and Trevino against Thaler are an opposite, because this Wiggins claim is not defaulted. It was presented in the state court proceedings, and it was adjudicated on the merits in those state court proceedings. The new evidence that Sells seeks to introduce does not make this a new claim, as Pinholster shows. This claim was raised and decided on the merits in state court. It is not procedurally defaulted. There are even parts of Mr. Sells' briefing that appear to agree with this proposition. For example, on page 5 of Mr. Sells' reply brief, he writes that, quote, "the claims remained the same, with the additional material merely supplementing them." The state agrees, and this is precisely why Mr. Sells' claim cannot get off the ground under Pinholster.
Is that brief in the instant case?
I'm sorry?
Is that the brief that they filed in the instant case?
Yes, it's a reply. The reply brief to the COA application. That's correct. Now, perhaps they didn't mean to say that Pinholster is controlling here. And we do acknowledge Pinholster was not mentioned in the state's response to the COA application. It should have been. And we corrected that deficiency as soon as possible with the 28J letter that we filed a few days ago. But also, I think, relevant is how Mr. Sells describes his claim on page 1 of his COA application. Here's how he describes his claim. Quote, "whether Mr. Sells' trial counsel provided ineffective assistance at the sentencing phase of his trial." That's the same claim that was raised in state court in the first state habeas application, the same claim that was raised in the third state habeas application, and it's the same claim that's being raised in the federal habeas application. There's different evidence that he's trying to use to support those claims, but the claim remains the same. Penholster remains binding and controls the outcome in this case. It compels the conclusion that Mr. Sells cannot obtain a certificate of appealability, nor can he obtain ultimate habeas relief on the Wiggins claim. The second claim that Mr. Sells raises surrounds the exclusion of a video that he wanted to introduce during the sentencing phase of his trial. This claim is also blocked by 2254D, and it is also blocked by Teague against Lane. There is no clearly established decision from the Supreme Court of the United States that holds that evidence of this sort must be admitted in the punishment phase of a capital trial. Sells does not cite any such decision in his COA application that even remotely addresses a fact pattern that resembles the situation that we have here. What Sells is asking this court to do is to extend previously existing case law into a new factual context. And Teague against Lane holds that any such extension of this sort must be effected on direct appeal and cannot be done on collateral attack. Mr. Sells' ineligibility for habeas relief on this claim is beyond dispute, and for that reason, a certificate of appealability cannot issue. Before I close, the state of Texas, with utmost respect, wants to suggest to the court that the amount of briefing and oral argument and judicial time that sometimes goes into deciding a certificate of appealability may be defeating the purpose of Section 2253C. And let me explain. The certificate of probable cause, which was the precursor to the certificate of appealability, was initially created by Congress in the early 20th century to prevent death row inmates from unduly delaying the execution of their sentences by filing meritless appeals. The COA device that exists today is designed to enable courts to take a peek at the merits of a case before deciding whether to authorize an appeal. Yet the amount of briefing that has gone into this case simply to decide whether a COA can issue, and the amount of time that has been consumed since Judge Garcia issued his decision in the district court almost a year ago, is enabling death row inmates in some situations to use the COA mechanism as an opportunity to induce further delay if it takes an entire year simply to decide whether the appeal can proceed in the first place. The state wants to just respectfully suggest that it's important to avoid allowing the certificate of appealability process to effectively serve as an appeal. And that almost can happen when we have 100-page briefs submitted on each side, oral argument that's being held, and a great length of time that elapses between the district court decision and the ultimate decision to issue the COA. And the state wants even to suggest that in some cases it may be better to have a COA issue quickly and have the appeal resolved rather than to have the certificate of appealability process prolonged for almost a year, only to have the COA eventually granted and then have the real appeal begin to proceed. And while the state is certainly grateful for the opportunity to present oral arguments to this court, the state just wants to respectfully caution against allowing the certificate of appealability procedure to be used as yet another tool of delay in the hands of condemned inmates.
I would say overall, Texas is pretty efficient in their execution scheme. You surpass all the other states in the nation.
We value efficiency, Judge Davis. We certainly do. If the court has no further questions, the state would respectfully ask this court to deny a certificate of appealability on each of the claims that Mr. Sells is asserting. Thank you, judges.
Thank you. Ms. Sherrod, you have some time for rebuttal.
I'm afraid I have quite a lot to say in 5 minutes, and much of it is responding to matters which have only arisen in the court in the last few minutes. First of all, with regard to what the director says about the certificate of appealability process, a matter that was never discussed at any time in this case prior to now. I would simply point out that when one represents a death-sentenced individual, the Certificate of Appealability is a critical document. I think that there has become a practice on the part of counsel of trying to assure that we put our best foot forward, knowing that if the Certificate of Appealability is denied, there is only one step left up the appellate ladder from here. And consequently, we do tend to brief in some depth. If the court is troubled by that, I would suggest that it is for the court to indicate that at some future date, but not to hold it against Mr. Sells that those currently representing him are attempting to represent his interests to the best of their ability. With regard to the pinholster matter, this is something which could have been previously raised and litigated. The respondent has entirely changed its position and is now seeking to raise on appeal something not raised below. As I've previously indicated, we would ask to be able to submit some supplemental briefing to address the specifics of this point, since it has been sprung on us, even had we received the electronic filing timely on Sunday night. It was extraordinarily short notice to raise a case which has been around now for, I think, about 3 or 4 years, and of which the state was well aware all along. If there is an inherent tension between Martinez and Pinholster, I would suggest that that actually adds an additional reason why this court may wish to remand for the matter to be considered below, properly briefed, and considered in a sensible and judicious fashion, rather than being done at the last minute as the director seeks to have it reviewed. Moving on to the question of whether the claim remains the same. Yes, the underlying claim is one of the Sixth Amendment, which should supply the bedrock guarantee of effective counsel in the trial court. But if Pinholster is to trump Martinez, that is something that needs to be addressed more thoroughly than this advocate can do in the next couple of minutes. And I would ask for the case to be remanded on that basis alone, if this court is seriously to consider it. Moving on to the Teague versus Lane point, another novelty in this case, since it has not been presented previously in the district court, it should have been presented, if it was to be timely presented, in the respondent's answer under the habeas rules, Rule 5, I believe. It was not. The new attorneys on this case are seeking to litigate issues for the first time at this point. Again, remand at the very least for this matter to be fleshed out would be appropriate. I would submit that it's inappropriate in an appellate court to bring up new matters, especially at this juncture, when there was not an opportunity to litigate below. And as to the substance of the Teague versus Lane argument, the law, I would submit, is clear. Yes, we say it should be applied to this particular fact, the fact of a video rather than hearsay evidence, but the law has been there for a very long time. And we cited cases, I think perhaps the most pertinent is Tenard versus Dretke in recent years, talking about the importance of the jury being able to consider mitigating evidence. And Tenard goes back to Skipper, the case about an inmate's behavior in prison while awaiting trial. And Tenard and Skipper and the whole line of cases preceding Tenard, the Penry cases, clearly the Supreme Court gives huge weight not only to the consideration of mitigating evidence as in the Penry line of cases, but I would submit it also logically must follow to the admission of evidence, such as was sought to be admitted in Skipper and in Simmons versus South Carolina. And with regard to this, the...
I believe you have a red light, Ms. Sharon.
And I will...
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time.